drum it calls my name. Through the mist and through the flame, echoes rise and break the chains. A whisper in the wind so pure, a heartbeat steady and sure. Reggae's voice becomes the cure. Oh, this sound, it lifts me higher. Like a spark ignites the fire. Spiritual vibrations feel the sound, lifting souls up from the ground. Oh, reggae.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, the place where we cut through the noise and get straight to the insights you need. If you're looking to quickly grasp complex topics, understand multiple perspectives, and maybe even have a few aha moments along the way, you are in exactly the right spot. Today, we're diving deep into a sound that vibrated its way from a small island to global stages, becoming far more than just music.
That's right. Today, our focus is reggae. A genre that's truly a global pulse, a powerful voice of resistance, and really a cultural force born from struggle, deep spirituality, and an undeniable yearning for liberation. Its journey, you know, from humble beginnings in downtown Kingston to a worldwide phenomenon, holds some pretty surprising turns.
To guide us through this incredible story, we've immersed ourselves in some fascinating material. We've pulled key insights from a BBC documentary titled Reggae, the Story of Jamaican Music, and we've also drawn heavily from a meticulously researched document by G. Ray Records. That one explores reggae's origins and its profound connection to the Rastafari movement.
So our mission for you, the listener, is to unpack the fascinating evolution of reggae. We'll trace its journey from those vibrant, competitive streets of Kingston, understanding the key cultural touch points, and exploring just how profoundly its unique sound and powerful message have shaped not only modern music, but also, well, global culture. So let's begin our deep dive.
Okay, let's start by setting the scene. August 5th, 1962. This was the day Jamaica finally gained its independence from British rule. After more than three centuries, you can just imagine the atmosphere, pure jubilation, right? A vibrant backdrop for a whole new musical era to emerge.
Mm-hmm. And the soundtrack to this new independent Jamaica was its first truly original music, ska. It had this incredibly simple, infectious rhythm that just made people jump to it, you know, brimming with a feeling of national pride. What's interesting, though, is that the music was actually developing before independence, but that surge of national pride definitely gave it an even greater drive. It's almost like the music saw freedom coming.
It's fascinating, isn't it? To realize that the real genesis of modern Jamaican music didn't actually start in recording studios. It really began much earlier, like in the early 1950s, in the poorer areas of downtown Kingston, with these things called sound systems.
Yeah, and these weren't your typical bands at all. A sound system was basically a mobile outdoor disco, complete with speakers so massive, as one person joked, you could raise a family in them. They pretty much replaced live orchestras at street dances. Apparently, the musicians took too many breaks. The source says, to eat a lot of pork.
Right.
The moment the first sound system started playing during one of those breaks, that was effectively the end of them.
And what were they playing on these sound systems? American R&B, wasn't it?
Exactly. Music from southern U.S. radio stations. You think Fats Domino, Ray Charles, Louis Jordan. It would just stream into the island, which is only about 90 miles away. These sound systems would blast those rhythms, turning downtown Kingston into this pulsing, dance-crazy hub almost every night.
And this wasn't just for fun. It became a business.
Oh, absolutely. It quickly morphed into a highly lucrative industry. Sound systems became the biggest local industry in downtown Kingston, operators would make what they call a bum, basically, a lot of money, by selling your own beer and curry goat to thousands of people dancing until like 6 a.m.
Wow, so serious competition must have developed.
Totally cutthroat. Everyone wanted the hottest American shirts. And out of this intense rivalry, two powerful figures emerged. Clement Coxone Dodd and Arthur Duke Reed. These two combined their liquor businesses with their sound system dances. And for about 15 years, they essentially controlled the Jamaican music business. The barons of downtown Kingston, as the sources call them.
The barons.
They really could rule the country those days.
So from playing records to making them, how did that shift happen?
Well, by the late 50s, these sound system operators moved into record producing. But here's the crucial twist. They weren't producing records to sell widely, not at first. They'd hire jazz musicians to create Jamaican versions of American R&B hits. Yep. But then they'd make only one single copy of each record.
Just one, seriously.
Yeah, just one. This exclusive copy, the exclusive, was solely for them to play on their own sound system. Ultimate bragging rights. And this process of imitation, focusing only on exclusivity, that inadvertently led to the creation of a completely new style.
And that's ska, that distinctive beat.
That's it. Trying to copy American R&B, they sort of stumbled upon Jamaica's first truly unique rhythm. Instead of the typical 1-2-3-4 beat, the emphasis shifted. It became more like 1-2 or 2-4, that upbeat feel. This was Jamaica's first musical revolution. They called it skia, or ska, and it was, as one source puts it, terribly influenced by Jamaican activities of the people.
So ska was really the music of the people.
Absolutely. It quickly became the way of life of the lower class people who, you know, haven't got anything else. It really highlights a massive social and cultural divide in Jamaica back then. It felt like we live in two countries. You had this vibrant, homegrown scene for the masses, while the middle and upper classes might just buy a ticket and go to Miami.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting. The Rastafarian connection. Prince Buster.
Right. So in 1960, Prince Buster, always looking for an edge, you know, to steal a march on his rivals, did something pretty radical. He approached the Rastafarians. Now, at the time, Rastafarians were the ultimate outcasts, seriously marginalized. There was even, apparently, a decree in Jamaica to kill Rasta. Huge pressure.
Wow. But they brought something crucial, musically.
Incredibly vital. Despite the persecution, they brought African rhythms into the mix. Things like kumina drumming, yabingi drumming, this chanting style called ninging, fused with the jazz influences already there. This formed the core of like 90% of all the grassroots music. Their contribution was undeniable. They were even part of the official independence pageant, which says a lot.
So with independence, people wanted to buy this music, not just hear it.
Exactly. The optimism was high. People wanted to own ska records. This created a new market, and the sound system guys, Coxone Dodd with Studio One, Duke Reed with Treasure Isle, Prince Buster with Voice of the People, they reinvented themselves again, this time as proper record companies.
And Studio One looms large here, doesn't it?
Hugely significant. Clement Dodd's Studio One. It was the first recording studio in Jamaica to be owned by a black man. A truly permanent place. Artists recorded there almost every day. People called it like home musically. It quickly got nicknamed Jamaica's Motown.
Jamaica's Motown?
Yeah, the place where all the great artists graduate.
I heard the auditions there were legendary.
Oh yeah. Every Sunday morning, hopefuls would gather in Coxone's yard waiting for their shot. He'd listen, sometimes telling artists, maybe come back 7 years' time if they weren't ready.
Tough crowd.
But he found stars quickly.
Like the Wailers.
That was a big one. Another group of youngsters he signed. The Wailers, Bunny Wailer, Bob Marley, Peter Tosh. In 1964, just a year after Studio One opened, their song, Simmer Down, sold like 70,000 copies. Astonishing. Downtown Kingston at this time was buzzing. One source called it like Piccadilly, like Hollywood, just alive with music.
It sounds like a really collaborative scene, too.
Definitely. If the Scatolites were recording, you'd find Bob, Peter, Bunny, other artists hanging around, maybe singing backup. They weren't paid much, mind you. Sometimes just a patty or coca bread, maybe a pound or 30 shillings on a Friday.
Wow.
But incredibly productive, hit after hit.
And a lot of this talent came from one place, Alpha Boys School.
Crucial piece of the puzzle. Alpha Boys School, often called the Juilliard School of Music for unfortunate youth. It taught them trades, but importantly, music. Many of Jamaica's greatest musicians came from Alpha, including the core of Coxone's house band, the legendary Scatolites.
The Scatolites.
Yeah.
The superstars of ska.
The first superstars, absolutely. These guys were masters, learned musicians. They played by paper, formally trained. Their dances, the Ram Jam sessions, were apparently wild. So energetic. There's that crazy story about a woman dancing until she dropped dead.
Good grief.
It just speaks to the power of their performances, right? The heartbeat of ska.
But this golden age didn't last long.
No, it was quite short-lived. Those 2 years right after independence, with the Skatalites at their peak, musicians got frustrated. Low pay, the scene felt kind of insular. And a key turning point, a really tragic one, was the story of Don Drummond.
The trombonist.
Yeah, the Skatalites' greatest genius, many say.
His playing was central to their sound.
Undeniably, that virtuoso trombone. He had this unique style with a disturbing emotional undertone, which sadly mirrored his own struggles with mental health. Tragically, New Year's Eve 1964, he killed his girlfriend, Margarita. He later died in Bellevue, the mental asylum. Yeah. They say the Skatalites were never quite the same after losing him. And this personal tragedy kind of reflected a bigger issue. Musicians couldn't make a decent living, so many talented artists packed their bags and joined thousands of other Jamaicans on the boat to England looking for better opportunities.
What was that like for them, arriving in London?
A bit of shock, often. London nightlife was strange, sometimes unnerving. They found themselves shut out of places. Jazz clubs, for instance. Hearing things like, sorry, you gotta be a member, or just the blunt truth, once you're black, you can't get in.
So they recreated their own scene. Sound systems again?
Exactly. Did what they knew best. They set up their own sound systems in London, imported records directly from Jamaica, from America too. Those records were like a letter from home for the growing Caribbean community. These dances, shebeen and blues dances, started just for Jamaicans. But pretty soon they started drawing in white working class kids too, creating this really interesting new cultural mix.
And ska in the UK became known as Bluebeat.
Largely, yeah. It was distributed on the Bluebeat label, so the name stuck. And Bluebeat became the soundtrack for the mods. You know, the scooter kids. They loved it. Flocked to the dances, identified with that rebellious energy.
Then came the big international breakthrough. Millie Small.
Yes. Pivotal moment. 1964. Chris Blackwell, the Jamaican record entrepreneur, later founded Island Records.
Right.
He brought a young singer, Millie Small, and the great guitarist, Ernest Ranglin, to London. The result was My Boy Lollipop. Went absolutely global, sold millions. That really put us on the map, as they say. And interestingly, that was the moment ska finally got accepted by the uptown people back in Jamaica, too. Not just a downtown thing anymore.
But back in Jamaica, things were changing again. Ska slowed down.
Yeah, conditions in downtown Kingston were getting tougher. Poverty breeds crime was becoming a harsh reality. That upbeat tempo of ska just didn't quite fit the mood on the streets anymore, so the music started to slow down. And that's how Rocksteady was born.
The era of the Rude Boys, too.
Mm-hmm. This was also the time of the Rude Boys, these ruthless gangsters causing trouble. They definitely influenced the music, inspired songs like Cry Tough or 007. There's that wild anecdote about a rude boy named Bosby.
Yeah.
Demanded a song be made about him. Got his wish. Died the next day. Apparently, producers quickly started cutting rude boy songs because of the eruption, the trouble they caused.
So Rocksteady was less instrumental, more about singers.
Yeah. It became Jamaica's first real pop music in that sense. Singers took center stage, lots of love songs. Though the influence of American R&B and soul was still strong. The Impressions, Dionne Warwick, The Supremes, you could hear it. For many artists back then, the dream was simple. Just hearing their voice on the radio, seeing people dance. There was apparently no thought of any money, really.
And Duke Reid became more prominent during Rocksteady.
Yes. His Trojan sound system really hit its stride. He saw the potential in Rocksteady's smoother, more easily dankable beat. The music was cut it down a little, as one source says, so the bassman could more move his fingers and have a line. Those melodic bass lines became key.
And Duke Reid himself, he had quite a reputation.
Oh, definitely. His Treasure Isle studio reflected that. He was known as a no-nonsense man, especially with the Rude Boys. Famously well-armed, carried at least 3 guns on him.
Wow.
Yeah, a real force to be reckoned with in that scene.
But Rocksteady didn't last that long either.
No, only about 18 glorious months, according to the sources. As conditions in Jamaica got even worse, the music shifted again, bass lines got heavier, subject matter became more socially concerned, and drum pattern changed crucially. It made the music even slow, it make it sound like it fast, that unique loping feel.
And that was...
That was the reggae, and suddenly reggae was everywhere.
And the UK market became even more important for reggae.
absolutely essential by the late 60s. You had a large, settled Caribbean community there, hungry for the music. Trojan Records especially targeted that market, and the large underground following Jamaican music already had.
This is where the skinhead connection comes in, which is kind of surprising looking back.
It is surprising now, yeah. These were white working class kids who were really into reggae, deeply. Despite the negative image skinhead later got back then, sources say they often protected black artists and the community. Reggae was our music for them, partly because it wasn't on mainstream radio. It felt like theirs.
The Trojan wanted it on mainstream radio.
They were determined, wanted to break reggae to the mass market. They even added strings sometimes, trying to make the track sound more like conventional pop records. There was this perception the BBC dismissed reggae. Stories about Bob Marley failing an audition.
Right.
But ultimately, reggae broke through anyway. It became part of pop mainstream. You had artists like Dave and Ansel Collins, Desmond Dekker, Jimmy Cliff, even Max Romeo with the really controversial track Wet Dream.
Huh, yeah, I remember that one.
They stormed the charts, filled huge venues like Wembley. The sound of downtown Kingston had conquered Jamaica, and now it had made its way right to the heart of the old colonial masters.
It's incredible, isn't it, how a sound from such specific struggles became so universal?
It really is. And when you dig into why, it nearly always points back to its deep roots. Reggae is genuinely more than a genre. It's that cultural force born from struggle, spirituality, and the yearning for liberation.
Yeah.
And it's so deeply intertwined with the Rastafari movement.
You can hear it in the music itself, those distinctive traits.
Definitely. Those offbeat rhythms, the skank, right? Where the guitar or keys hit the upbeats, gives it that relaxed but driving feel.
Mm-hmm.
Then the heavy bass lines, the steady drum patterns, often that call and response vocal style,
mm-hmm.
and the language, Jamaican patois, English, or sometimes Ayoric, the Rasta dialect.
And the Rastafari movement itself started in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Inspired by Marcus Garvey.
Exactly. Garvey's prophecy. Look to Africa where a black king shall be crowned. For Rastafari, that king was Haile Selassie I, the emperor of Ethiopia. They revere him as Yah, as God incarnate.
And their core beliefs. Repatriation, Babylon.
Right. Repatriation to Africa, not always literally, but as a spiritual homeland. Rejecting Babylon, which is their term for the oppressive Western system, materialism, corruption, you know. And, of course, the sacramental use of ganja for meditation, reasoning, connecting with Jah. It's centered on African pride, natural living, unity. As the source says, Rastafari is not just a religion, it's a way of life.
So reggae became the voice for this way of life.
It absolutely became the musical vessel for the Rasta message. As the genre matured, artists consciously infused their music with spiritual themes, biblical references, powerful calls for justice, liberation. That really cemented reggae as the sacred rhythm of resistance.
And artists like Bob Marley were central to spreading that message globally.
Central is the word. Marley, a devout Rasta, used reggae to spread messages of unity, liberation, spiritual consciousness. Think of Exodus, redemption song, Yah Live, powerful stuff. But also others like Peter Tosh, Burning Spear, Culture, all echoing themes of African identity, equal rights, standing against Babylon. Even the Nibingi drumming, that traditional Rasta ritual rhythm, deeply influenced reggae's heartbeat, its meditative feel.
And this global impact was formally recognized.
Yes, in 2018, UNESCO recognized reggae as an intangible cultural heritage of humanity, honoring its huge role in promoting peace, dialogue, social commentary around the world.
So bringing it to today, how does all this rich history still shape music? Its influence seems everywhere.
It really is like a deep bass line running through so much modern music. Subtle sometimes, but powerful. You see it clearly in genre fusion and innovation. Artists blend reggae with electronic music, reggaetronica, think Major Lazer. Hip-hop artists like Nas and Damian Marley mixing conscious rap with reggae's depth, reggae rap. Or artists like Ozuna weaving reggae grooves into Latin pop and reggaeton. It's incredibly versatile.
And lyrically, too, that tradition of social commentary.
Absolutely. That speaking truth to power aspect deeply influences lyrical consciousness and social commentary today. Themes of inequality, justice, empowerment. They're central now in hip-hop, trap soul, R&B, even indie pop.
Yeah.
Reggae really showed modern music that rhythm can carry revolution, you know?
What about the sound itself? Production techniques?
Huge impact there. Dub music, which came directly out of reggae.
Right, the remixes and effects.
Exactly. Dub pioneered remixing, echo effects, super heavy bass production, techniques that are totally standard now in EDM, trap, lo-fi music. And that basic one-drop rhythm, the offbeat skank, still vital production elements today.
And its influence beyond just music,
mm-hmm.
cultural movements.
Still going strong. Reggae's global reach and cultural movements continue to inspire things like Pan-Africanism, environmental activism, social justice movements worldwide. You see its cross-cultural appeal at huge festivals like Rotem Sunsplash or Rebel Salute, drawing really diverse crowds.
And finally, how it affects us, the listeners.
Well, in terms of audience psychology, reggae's unique vibe, that chill yet conscious feel, has shaped how we engage with music. It just naturally encourages emotional connection, reflection, a sense of community. Its rhythm promotes relaxation, mindfulness. It's even influenced wellness music, ambient genres. It's more than just tunes. It's a mood, a philosophy, almost a way of being.
So we've journeyed from those humble, fiercely competitive sound systems of downtown Kingston through all the social struggles and incredible musical innovation, to reggae's eventual conquest of global stages, including right into the heart of the old colonial masters.
Yeah, and what this deep dive really shows, I think, is that reggae isn't just a genre. It's this profound cultural and spiritual force that genuinely continues to echo the heartbeat of liberation, love, and divine connection all around the world.
Which leaves us with a thought to maybe mull over. Considering how music born of such specific struggle and cultural identity managed to evolve into a truly universal language, what does that tell us about the power of art itself? Its power to transcend boundaries and connect people right across the globe.
Melody divine, healing the heart, transcending.